Okay. Thanks for the opportunity to talk here today. So everything I'm going to talk about today was done in collaboration with my advisor, Xiaogang Wen, at MIT. So what am I going to talk about today? Well, basically, I'm going to describe for you a connection between topological order and quantum entanglement, in particular, entanglement entropy. But before I describe that connection for you, I first want to just very quickly review the basic theory of topological order and topological phases, and really for two reasons. One is I want to make sure that we're just sort of speaking the same language. And also, I think I want to explain for you why this connection between topological order and quantum entanglement is important or interesting, put it in sort of context. So that's what I'm going to talk about. One other thing I'd like to say is, for those of you who were at my talk in January here at Santa Barbara, there'll be somewhat large overlap with that, so feel free to leave if, you know, if you're bored or something. I won't be offended. Okay, so the first thing I want to do is just very quickly sort of review the theory of topological phases and topological order. So what are topological phases? Well, the first property is that they are quantum phases of matter. So strictly speaking, they can only exist at zero temperature. And they're quantum phases of matter with a topological character, which makes them fundamentally different from any familiar phase like superconductor or ferromagnet or anything like that. So what is this topological character? Well, let me just quickly sort of review their basic physical properties. So the first physical property of topological phases is that they're gapped. If I have like a slab of material in a topological phase and I look at the energy spectrum, I'll find a finite gap delta separating the ground state from the excited states. So you might say, well, that's not particularly exotic. What's so new and interesting about these phases? Well, the new and interesting property, of course, is that if you then take this slab of material and you imagine wrapping it up into, say, a torus or a donut, and you then look at the energy spectrum, you'll again find a finite gap delta separating the ground states from the excited states. But what you'll find is you'll find typically a multiply degenerate ground state. So you might find, say, three degenerate ground states. So again, you might say, what's so exotic about that? Any system with discrete symmetry breaking will have degenerate ground states. You know, like a ferromagnet, for example, has one ground state where the spins point up and one ground state where the spins point down. So you say, okay, what's so special about this? Well, this this degeneracy has nothing to do with symmetry or symmetry breaking. I can add any perturbation I like to the Hamiltonian, break all the symmetries I like, and I can never split this degeneracy. It really comes from sort of the topological degeneracy. Somehow the system feels the topology of the surface it lives on, which is kind of interesting because it has a finite gap delta, so there are no sort of long-range correlations, yet somehow it feels this global topology. It's a very interesting property and very exotic, I would say. So the third property of topological phases, and the one that we've sort of focused on the most in this program, is fractional statistics. So if I look at excitations above the ground state, and I imagine these excitations will typically have a particle-like character to them, they're quasi-particles, and if I braid one excitation around another, it'll typically acquire some kind of phase, e to the I theta. So these quasi-particles typically, they're neither bosons nor fermions, they have fractional statistics, possibly even non-abelian fractional statistics. So again, this is something quite exotic that you would never see in a traditional phase.
May I make a remark on your previous sentence? You can never relate this to symmetry breaking, but if you think of local symmetries and you break local symmetries, then you certainly can do it. And you keep this, you get this general symmetry, you cannot break up any further. So it was I thought it was too strong to say it had nothing to do with symmetry breaking. If you break a gauge symmetry to a discrete gauge symmetry, you can do all these things, and you get exactly.
Okay, but in a condensed matter context,
but that symmetry breaking is not.
So, like, local symmetries don't exist in some sense. And
maybe not.
Yeah. Okay, so anyway.
This is mother physics or not, it's a mother of language, I think.
Okay, so fair enough. There may be something there. But in any case, these are sort of these properties reflect some kind of underlying order which has a topological character to it. So we say that these phases have topological order. And I would say that this is sort of a physical definition of topological phases and topological order. any phase with these properties is a topological phase, and vice versa. So we can take this as kind of a working definition. So we have these beautiful phases, and of course the next question is, what are our examples of them? And of course we have beautiful example of them, fractional quantum Hall liquids that we've been talking about this whole program. If you take the Laughlin state and put it on a torus, you'll find a ground state degeneracy. In that case, you find a threefold degeneracy for the nu equals one-third state. If you take the quasi-particles and braid them around each other, you'll get a phase. So the Laughlin state, I guess it's e to the I 2 pi over 3. For the Fockian, you get something non-abelian. So we really have a beautiful example of these phases. And you might wonder, do we have any other examples out there other than a fractional quantum Hall liquid? And at the moment, we really don't have any certain examples or any candidates that are as strong as these. But there's a lot of hope that you might find these types of phases in systems such as frustrated magnets, quantum frustrated magnets. And at the moment, we have a lot of theoretical models of frustrated magnets, which have topological phases in them. And we have a few candidate materials which, while they're probably not in topological phases, they may be in at least cousins of topological phases, or they seem close to a topological phase in some sense. So if you're an optimist, you might say, okay, there may be lots of these phases out there, and we really need to think about sort of a general theory of topological phases and not focus so much on, you know, say, a particular system. So...
How do you pronounce the last line on that
slide? This? Yeah, everyone makes fun of me for that. They're like, you never say what this is. Like, when I talk about this in more detail, I say, this organic compound, it's an organic superconductor. I have no idea how to pronounce it.
The friendly name is Kappa B.
Like, this is some organic molecule. I have no idea. So in any case, I guess what I'm trying to motivate here is the need for developing sort of a theory, a general theory of topological phases. And you know, the kind of theory we're looking for is a theory analogous to our theory of symmetry-breaking phases, because that's a very powerful theory, which has really been crucial to condensed matter theory for, you know, for the last 50 years. So we like to develop a theory for topological phases along those lines, and you know, we've made a lot of progress towards that. So at the moment, we have a pretty good understanding of the low-energy effective theories of these phases. They're described by something called topological quantum field theory. And we have some understanding of sort of what mathematical framework you use to classify these phases. It involves mathematical objects known as tensor categories. And we have some kind of physical picture for these phases, a microscopic picture for how they might come about, at least the non-chiral phases, involving strings or extended objects. So we've made some progress, but we're actually missing a lot. We're not even close to sort of a general theory of topological phases and topological order. And what I want to focus in this talk is a particular hole in our understanding of topological phases and topological order. So what is this hole? Well, I would say that the problem is our physical characterization of these phases is incomplete. It's weak in some sense. It's not nearly as good as our characterization of symmetry-breaking phases. So what do I mean by that? Well, let me give you sort of a more explicit point. So we know how to sort of detect symmetry-breaking order in a wave function. If someone hands you a wave function on spin, say a numerical wave function, and they ask you, is there, you know, some kind of broken symmetry in this wave function, we know how to look for that, right? We look for some kind of long-range order, some kind of correlation function between spins, right? It's very simple and straightforward, at least in principle. But we don't know how to do this in the case of topological order. If someone hands you sort of a generic wave function for some many-body system or some spins, how do you look for topological order there? What is topological order? I mean, that's part of, it's kind of weird, you know, but the very word suggests that it's some kind of order in a state, right? But how do you see it? What is it? Is there a way to measure it numerically, for example, just given a wave function? And the answer is we don't really have such a way. I mean, if you look back at sort of the way I characterize them back here, I sort of characterize them using Hamiltonians to a large extent. Or, you know, for example, here, degenerate ground states. Well, in some, you know, in some sense, this is using a Hamiltonian, right? At the very least, I have to put the system on a tour somehow to find the topological order. It's kind of strange. And here, the fractional statistics. I have to look at excitations above the ground states to find the topological order. Again, I need kind of a Hamiltonian, or I need more information. But you shouldn't need that, right? Topological order should be encoded in the wave function. It's a property of a state, a ground state. So what I want to talk about in this talk, I think this isn't just a conceptual problem, the fact that we can't detect topological order. It's also kind of a more practical problem, because there are a lot of wave functions floating out there that have been proposed over the last 10 or 15 years. So there are a lot of, for example, theoretical wave functions that, you know, people have come up with. So one example that's very popular in sort of high TC community are Gutzwiller projected states. So these are wave functions on spins that are obtained by taking some kind of fermions on a lattice, say spin 1/2 fermions, and you have some wave function on those fermions, maybe a fairly simple wave function on fermions, but then you project down into the subspace where there's only one fermion on any given site, and that gives you a wave function on spins, and it can be a very complicated wave function. And it's believed that these wave functions have all kinds of exotic properties, and perhaps some of them are topologically ordered and so on, but we really don't know how to say that precisely or understand that, because we don't know how to detect topological order. And the other class of wave functions that's of interest to people here are these quantum loop gas wave functions. So these are wave functions on loops. X here is sort of a configuration of loops in the plane. And the amplitude for some configuration of loops is just d raised to the power of the number of loops. So it's a very simple wave function. And it's believed that, you know, for certain values of d, you know, these wave functions have some connection with topological states, perhaps are topologically ordered. But again, we don't really know how to say anything precise about them, because we don't know how to detect topological order. Now, this isn't just a problem theoretically, there's also a numerical issue. So, good example is the J1, J3 spin 1/2 Heisenberg model. So this is just a spin 1/2 model on the square lattice with nearest neighbor and third nearest neighbor interactions. Pretty simple model, and it's believed that in certain parameter regime, it's in the topological phase. But again, we don't really know what to do with this, because currently the only things that people have been able to do, because of the numerical method they used, is just to look for traditional symmetry breaking order. And they couldn't find any symmetry breaking order in the wave function, and so the conclusion is it must be spin liquid, it's probably topologically ordered, so on. But we don't really know how to directly look for topological order. Yeah?
Let me just ask, you said a moment ago that you should be able to detect topological order just from the wave function, ground state wave function. What about the fact that we know examples of where the same wave function occurs for two different Hamiltonians, one of which is in the topological phase?
So we should be able to tell if a wave function, like suppose a wave function is a ground state of a topologically ordered, of a Hamiltonian with a gap that's topologically ordered, then we should be able to see that it's potentially a ground state.
Potentially.
Yeah. Of course, you could construct strange, sort of finely tuned Hamiltonians which have it, which are gapless, right? But what I'm saying is, for generic Hamiltonian, which has it as its ground state and gap, it's topologically ordered.
Mike?
Yeah.
What's the third nearest neighbor means?
Oh, so on a square lattice. So on a square lattice, so. These are the first neighbor is right next to me, right here, right? Second neighbor is diagonal. Third nearest neighbor is actually two steps away.
And I want to call it horizontal vertically.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. It means third closest, like geometrically, just in distance. Okay. So what I want to describe for you in this talk is a way to sort of solve this problem, one way to detect topological order in a wave function. Okay, so how does it work? Well, the basic idea involves something called topological entropy. And to explain this, I have to just very quickly review what entanglement entropy is. So, I don't know if I should turn on a light or something. Yeah. So suppose you have some collection of spins on a lattice. and you have some region, sub-region of the lattice, then and you have some wave function on these spins, psi, right? Then you can define the entanglement, call this region here A. You can define the entanglement entropy of A basically by calculating the density matrix, the reduced density matrix for this region. So that's called rho A. And then just taking rho log rho. And then that gives you a quantity called the entanglement entropy, which basically measures to what extent this region is entangled with the surrounding region. So that's entanglement entropy. And topological entropy, basically, it can be defined in terms of entanglement entropy. So the way it works is the following. Imagine someone gives you some wave function on spins, say, just in some disk-like region like this, say a numerical wave function. You want to compute the topological entropy. How do you do it? What you do is you pick, one way of doing it is the following. You could pick these four regions, these four blue regions, which I've shown here, and compute each of their entanglement entropies. So that's S1, S2, S3, and S4, the four entanglement entropies. And then you can take this linear combination. So the claim is that if you take this linear combination in the limit that these regions are very large, it converges to some constant called the topological entropy. So why am I telling you about this weird constant that you can compute in this way? Well, it turns out that this topological entropy has a number of very interesting properties. So the first property is that it's zero if the system is not topologically ordered. And it's non-zero if it is topologically ordered. So immediately it gives you a way to distinguish topologically ordered states from non-topologically ordered states. The second property is that it's actually a universal constant. It doesn't depend on any microscopics or anything like that. And we know what the value of this constant is. It's given by log d squared, where d is something called the quantum dimension that's associated with the topological phase. And let me just give you an example of what d would be for certain cases. So for example, in the case, if you're, in a Laughlin state where nu equals 1/3, then if you use this formula here, you get d equal to the square root, the sum over all the quasi-particles of di squared, which is equal to square root of 1 squared plus 1 squared plus 1 squared. There are three quasi-particles. Each have dimension 1. So you get square root of 3. In the case of, say, z2, there are four quasi-particles, each of dimension 1. So you get 2. And there, I could give you more examples. But this is just, it's just some number, and you can compute it if you know the basic structure of the topological phase you're dealing with. Okay, so once we measure this quantity numerically, we can it'll not only tell us if it's topologically ordered or not, it could also tell us what kind of topological order. So for example, if you do a numerical experiment and you get log 4 here, then you're pretty sure that it might be a Z2 theory. On the other hand, if you get 1/2 log 3, if you get log 3, then it's probably basically this topological order in the nu equals 1/3 state. So this is nice, and this is what I'm going to talk about in this talk. And if you're interested in knowing more about it, we posted this on ConMat a few months ago. And I should also mention that Alexey Kateyev and John Preskill posted a very similar result also there, and their result is, it's done in a different way, and it's very elegant and interesting. And you should totally, if you're interested, you should definitely look at their paper as well, because they have a different viewpoint that's very nice.
In the classification of TQFTs by Moore and Seibert, there's some additional information beyond just D.
Is it
true that if all the dimension numbers are zero, then there's no interesting TQFT?
The interesting one would be where D, you mean non-interesting, so...
Well, I guess here, so you have a probe of D.
Yeah.
D squared.
Yeah. What you're asking is if D squared equals 1, I think. That's the trivial case, right?
D squared is equal to 1.
Yeah. If D squared equals 1, then that means there can be at most one quasi-particle type with D equals 1. So that's trivial. That's a trivial theory. Because all the Ds here are greater than or equal to 1. So So that's what, that's sort of, this statement is kind of a special case of this statement here. Yeah.
Suppose you have like Dawkins with a finite boundary, and but in such a way that along the boundary you would do that gap of that's this real symbol.
Yeah, I believe so. So you'd still do the entanglement entropy in the interior, far from the boundary. The boundary shouldn't affect the interior as long as you're far away from it, right? You do it, so no one's ever done that, but if you actually did it in the Laughlin state, you should get log 3. Okay, so now I want to explain to you why this result is true. So the first thing I want to do is just give you a physical picture. So why is this zero for normal phases and non-zero for topological phases? Well, the answer is, in crude terms, it's very simple. It's non-local entanglement. It's sort of what I was alluding to earlier. These topologically ordered states have a very non-trivial kind of entanglement that has a non-local character to it. And this quantity that I wrote down is designed to measure this kind of non-local entanglement. So it's specifically designed to measure the sort of special property of the topological order. Yeah?
We put some of these, so do you have in mind some kind of group behind that, or this would be the dimension of the presentation?
So, yeah, okay, so that's a very good... Yeah, so in the case where, for example, you're right. So in the case where this is, say, a... That's a general example. So in the case where the topological phase is a discrete gauge theory with gauge group G, so consider that case. In that case, d alpha would be the dimension of the irreducible representations of the quantum double, that group. And then d here is just the size of the group. So in general, d is just the size of the gauge group.
Can you calculate topological degeneracy from this entanglement?
Not that I know of. No, these are different. So this is not always an integer. This can be irrational. But maybe there's a way, I don't know. Okay, so the claim is that there's some kind of non-local entanglement that this is designed to measure. So first let me explain to you why I say this. Topologically ordered states have non-local entanglement. So let's look at a specific example. So what I've drawn here is an exactly soluble spin model in the honeycomb lattice. This is the Kataev toric code model. And the spins here are located on the links of the honeycomb lattice. Okay? And there are two interactions. A three-spin interaction between three spins adjacent to a given site. And then a six-spin interaction between six spins adjacent to a given pluck head. And that's it. And you know, it's an highly unphysical Hamiltonian, but it's exactly soluble, and you can show that the ground state has Z2 topological order explicitly. So let's try to understand this example, since it's exactly soluble. So let's look at the ground state. What is the ground state for this model? Well, turns out that it's exactly soluble, we can say exactly what the ground state is. And the easiest way to describe the ground state is to use something called the string picture. So how does that work? Well, basically, I want to think of spin states in terms of strings. And the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to use the following language. If on a given link, sigma x equals minus 1, I'll say that there's a string on that link. And if on a given link, sigma x equals plus 1, I'll say there's no string on that link. So using that language, I get some configuration of strings. And it turns out that the ground state wave function is very simple in this language. It's just a uniform superposition of all possible string configurations. It's kind of like a Roxar-Kivelsen type state. Just take all possible string configurations with exactly the same amplitude. That's the ground state. Okay, so we know what the ground state is exactly. Now let's try to see, why do I say it has non-local entanglement? Well, imagine zooming out a little bit. So the ground state is just this kind of superposition of all these loops. And imagine looking for some kind of local correlation between two spins. Say here and here. It's not hard to see, at least intuitively, that if you look at any correlation like this between two spins, sigma x and sigma x, you'll get zero. There are no correlations between local operators that are well separated because it's a superposition of all possible loops. Whether or not there's a string going through this link is totally uncorrelated with whether there's a string going through this link. So these types of correlations will all vanish. So there are no local correlations. However, there is a non-local correlation. So to see that, imagine drawing this blue curve here. Because of the structure of the state, it's not hard to see that the total number of crossings of this blue curve has always got to be even, right? Because we're dealing with closed loops. So what that means is, if I take a product of sigma x along all the spins along this loop, then that always has to be exactly 1. It can never be minus 1, because there's always an even number of crossings, an even number of minus 1s. So what does this mean? It means the following. If I take any subset of these spins, you know, 3 or 4 of these spins, and I look for some kind of correlation, I'll find nothing, no correlation. But if I look at all of them together, there is a correlation here. So there's a non-local correlation, non-local entanglement. So how the question you might ask is this that general? Because, you know, you're dealing with this very special, exactly soluble point. How general is this property? Well, actually, I want to argue for you that it's quite general. So let's imagine we take the Kitaev model and we perturb it a little bit. We add some little perturbation. So this particular perturbation, which I've drawn here, is very simple. It basically creates a little virtual charge, pairs of charges. It breaks strings virtually. So if you add this little perturbation, it's not hard to see that basically what's going to happen to the ground state is it's just going to have little gap, there'll be little breaks in the string due to the virtual creation of these virtual charges. And there'll also be little segments of string that are sort of created. So you'll get basically the original state with like these sort of virtual string breaking fluctuations on top. So the ground state will look something like this if you perturb it. So now the question is, if we have some perturbed state like this, is there still some kind of string correlation there? What's going on? Well, let's look at the original string correlation we looked at, which was this product of sigma x. So this correlation no longer works, because we no longer have the even-odd property that we said earlier, right? I mean, we can have little virtual, you know, these little pieces of string that are being created, they ruin the even-odd property, right? So in general, when you sum over all the possibilities, you're going to get 0, at least for a long string.
Is epsilon bigger than the gap or smaller than the gap?
Oh, this is much smaller than the gap. Yeah.
So these are purely virtual.
Yeah. So what would happen as you get, when it reached the gap, is these would get... So basically, the fact that it's smaller than the gap means that this is some length scale, which they don't separate beyond that length. If we reach the gap, these would be huge breaks. It would be a different... Yeah. Okay. So this string operator doesn't work anymore. There's no string correlation. So you might say, okay, maybe the string correlation is sort of a special property of this exactly soluble point. But it's not, because what you have to do is imagine fattening the string operator a little bit. Don't take such a thin one. This was sort of a string operator with 0 width. Take a fatter string operator whose width is larger than this typical distance. Okay? So if you take a string operator like that, and it's not hard to see, at least by looking at it, that there must be some operator acting on these spins which will still measure this even-odd property. In other words, if you as a human being can look at this picture and tell that just from the spins in here, you can tell that this is sort of a virtual thing. You could, you know, not worry about this. And you could count the total number of real crossings of this thickened string, and you would get an even number. So there is some operator, fattened string operator, with a width on the order of the correlation length, which will measure this correlation. So it's a very complicated operator, but it's there. And this is true very generally. So in all topological phases, whether they're spin models or fractional quantum Hall or anything, there's always string operators like this with a width on the order of the correlation length, which measure these type of correlations. And actually, there's usually more than one. There's a string operator for each quasi-particle type. So in the Z2 theory, there are actually 4 string operators. But I've only drawn one here because for simplicity. So these string operators are very general, and they exist in all phases. And they're really the fundamental difference between topological phases or topologically ordered states and regular normal states is the existence of these correlations. So now we kind of have an idea of how to detect topological order. We need to look for these string-like correlations, right? The problem is they're very complicated. Like, even in this case, I couldn't even write down the explicit operator. It's incredibly complicated. So how can we look for the correlation if we can't actually write it down? So then that's where the idea of sort of information theory comes in. Sometimes you can, using information theory, at least you can find that there is a correlation without explicitly finding its explicit form, right? So if you have, like, classically, if you have a collection of spins, I'll erase this. If you have, like, say, just let's consider a classical problem. If I have a collection of spins, say, arranged in a loop, they're, you know, and let's imagine that each one of these spins is some classical spin, like sigma z. You could imagine some classical ensemble where there's you know, some very short-range interactions between the spins, okay? But in addition to the short-range interactions, there's also some kind of restriction, like product of sigma z equals 1, some kind of global correlation, like this. And you could ask yourself, if someone handed you some ensemble, some classical ensemble on spins, how could you find such a correlation? And the answer is, you know, it could be a very it might not be this simple, right? It could be some very complicated correlation involving all the spins. You could find it by calculating the entropy of the loop, and noticing that the entropy of the loop is smaller than you expect, right? Because of the existence of this correlation, the total number of states that are going to occur in the ensemble is smaller than you would expect. So basically, by looking at the total entropy of this loop, you could find the correlation. And that's exactly what this topological entropy, the idea there is. The idea is we're going to look at the, in this case we're doing with a quantum system. So we're going to look at sort of the quantum mechanical entropy of this loop, entanglement entropy. And the quantum mechanical entanglement entropy of this loop is going to be smaller than you would expect, basically, in some sense, because of the existence of these non-local correlations. Okay? And so the question is, how do you find that sort of discrepancy between what you expect and...
Is that loop the same loop as the one that we talked about before?
What do you mean? Which one? Well, that's the pictures were the same. The point is, as long as this thickness is longer than sort of the correlation length, there will exist a sort of thickened string correlation inside.
It actually looks like you have a counterexample to that on the slide before.
What?
So if you have a break like this, now we sort of rotate it just outside the.
No. So the point is that with any thickness, you're never going to, I'm not sure if this is related to what you're saying, but with any thickness, you're never going to get the correlation perfectly. It's only going to be exponentially good, depending on thickness. I'm not sure if that's related to what you're saying, but yeah, it is true that these fat and string operators will never get a perfect correlation, you know, as good as the, you know, we did in the exactly soluble case where it's exactly one, but it'll be exponentially good. Okay, so that's the point here. The entropy of this loop is going to be smaller than we'd expect. But how do we find that discrepancy? Well, the way we find the discrepancy is through some careful sort of engineered calculation where we try to cancel out everything so that all we get left is this sort of discrepancy. So that's what this is. So let's look closely at what this formula says. So let's look at S1 minus S2. S1 minus S2 is the entropy in this region minus this region. So it's basically the entropy associated with deleting this sort of region at the top, right? And let's look at S3 minus S4. You know, again, that's the entropy associated with deleting this region at the top. So naively, you would say S1 minus S2 and S3 minus S4 should be the same, because the only difference is whether they're connected at the bottom, and if these two are far away from each other, no way. The effect of the bottom is exponentially small. So this should vanish exponentially with size. So that would be true if there was no non-local correlation between all the spins. But because there's a non-local correlation between all the spins, S1, this entropy, is smaller than you would expect. So this whole quantity here is negative. So you get a positive value for the topological entropy. So the topological entropy is measuring that correlation. Now, I want to say this is just one construction. There are other ways of... Alexei Kateyev has a different way of combining regions to get, you know, this number out. But this is just one way to try to sort of isolate this piece. Okay. So, let's see, what should I do? Okay, so basically, I hope I've argued for you that this quantity is explained, at least, why it's zero for normal phases and non-zero for topological phases. And maybe I've sort of waved my hands as to why it's universal, involving these sort of fat and string operators. But what I really want to do in the rest of the time was, what I want to do is give you an explicit example and show you that it really does equal log d squared, at least in this z2 case. So just do an explicit example.
Question?
Yeah.
So it seems that you haven't shown that this measure is zero or non-zero, but that you rather have some sort of statistical confidence in that it's zero or non-zero, because there's some finite width that you always have to consider. And if you think of this as some sort of non-local order parameter, you've got, you know, some thickness that you're considering. It could be that you're unlucky and that the distribution of errors is such that even with the width that you've chosen, you're not able to detect topological order even if it's there.
Well, okay, so what the statement, I think, of what you're saying is the following. If I actually do this calculation on finite regions, not infinite regions, then I won't get exactly log 4. I'll get some corrections to that, exponentially small corrections to log 4. But those corrections will vanish exponentially in the size of the system. Yeah?
Let me just try to serve as interpreter, because you've gotten two questions. I think they're based on misunderstanding of what you said was the fatness of fat and loop operator.
Okay.
I think people are thinking that you're going to take some kind of average of the parallel copies of the dotted line from the fixed strand, whereas you were proposing something more interesting. I don't think it made it
clear enough. Oh, yeah. Okay, maybe you're right. So what do I mean by the fat and string operator? I didn't really explain it. The problem is that it's hard for me to write it down explicitly. The point is, what you would probably do, the way this operator would work, is the following. You'd look at the strings, and then anytime you see sort of a string configuration, which is anytime you see something isolated like this, you know, which is separated by a large distance greater than this distance scale, you would sort of not worry about it, not count it. And similarly, anytime you see like a small gap, which is, you know, separated by, which is, you know, doesn't, with no other gaps nearby within this distance scale, you would fill it in. And then after doing that operation, you would count the total number of crossings, and that will always be even or odd with exponentially small.
Right, exponentially small, but not exact, right? That's
So that's why you only get exponentially small, you'll get an exponentially small correction to this, yeah.
So is it true then that you're never exactly certain that the entropy is zero or not?
You'll never get zero, yeah, right. Exactly. You'll get something slightly, you'll always get something slightly positive. Because basically, because there's some, another way of saying, there are lots of reasons why you'll get something positive. I mean, there are always some residual correlations between the bottom and the top, even without any topological order for any finite system. It's just when you get to infinite systems that these correlations.
But isn't it also relevant that even from simplest topological theory, there's a gap
Yeah, these are discrete numbers. So if you get something that's like log 4 plus 0.02, it's a pretty good indication of log 4. Okay. So what I wanted to do was to just do an example. Hopefully we'll have time for this. I'll just do an explicit example just to clarify what's really going on here. So let's go back to this exactly soluble example, and let's compute this entanglement entropy. You can do it exactly. So how do we do it? Well, first let's remember the wave function. The wave function is just a superposition of all possible loop configurations. This configuration plus every other configuration of loops. And let's imagine we want to compute the entanglement entropy. First we'll just do the entanglement entropy of a closed region like this. Simple disk-like region. Okay, so how are we going to compute the entanglement entropy? Well, the first step is to define some wave functions, which I'm going to call psi n. So this is actually a collection of wave functions parameterized by q1 through qn, where q1 through qn can be either 0 or 1, and the sum of them is even. So how are these wave functions defined? Well, for any sort of collection of q1, qi's, That specifies a boundary condition, basically whether or not there's a string on these links. Okay? And then the way psi n is defined is sort of very natural. It's just a sum over all loop configurations in the interior consistent with that boundary condition. So that gives you a wave function on the spins inside this region. It's just a sum over all possible loop configurations consistent with that boundary. So it would be this configuration plus another one plus many others. So that's a wave function for spins inside the region. You can also define a wave function for spins outside the region the same way. You can define some psi outs, which will, again, for any given q's, will just be a sum of all possible loop configurations consistent with that boundary condition. Okay, so we've defined these two sets of wave functions. Now the idea is the following. Let's imagine we sum over all, we take psi in times psi out. That gives you a wave function on all the spins. And we sum over all the boundary conditions, q. Okay, then by doing this, we've sort of effectively, we've glued together this inside wave function and outside wave function. And since we're summing over all the q's, we're going to basically sum over all possible loop configurations. So in the end, you're just going to get all possible loop configurations, and they're all going to have amplitude 1, because these each had amplitude 1. So you're just going to get psi out. Psi is what you get in the end when you do this procedure. So we have this nice expression for psi. And once you have this expression for psi, it's easy to calculate the entanglement entropy. Basically, what you do is you imagine, it turns out that these psi out wave functions are orthonormal, or up to a, so they can be treated as sort of an orthonormal basis. And to compute the density matrix, we can just trace out the psi outs. And if you trace out the psi outs, it's easy to see that you're just going to get an equal mixture of all the psi in states. So the density matrix is just an equal mixture of all the psi in states. And so then to calculate the entropy, we just have to know how many psi ins are there. So you might say, oh, there are 2 to the n psi ins, because there are 2 choices on each of the n links. But actually, we have this condition. The total number of crossings has to be even. Like, it doesn't make sense to define a psi in for something where there are an odd number of crossings. So there aren't 2 to the n. There's a constraint. The total number of crossings have to be even. So there are only 2 to the n minus 1 different psi ins. So since there are 2 to the n minus 1, the entropy is just n minus 1 log 2. So that's the entropy of this region. But once you have that, you can already see, by the way, the topological entropy. It's basically this piece here. Okay, so now once you have that, it's easy to generalize it to sort of a general region. So for a general region which has, say, some more complicated topology, it's just n minus k log 2, where k is the number of boundary curves, the number of components to the boundary.
Like, is that log base 2?
It depends on your convention. I do natural log, but maybe information theory would say log base 2. Yeah. Okay. So this is the general formula. Once you have the general formula, we can just compute everything. So now let's do that. So if we do it for these 4 regions, for this region we get n1 minus 2, because there are 2 components log 2. And this region we get n2 minus 1, because there's only 1 component. And then similarly for these, where n1, n2, n3, and n4 are just the total number of links along the boundary in these 4 cases. So this is what you get. Now you just take the linear combination of them. So you take this linear combination, you get this. But now here's where sort of the special geometry comes in, which is, it's not hard to see that n1 minus n2 is exactly the same thing as n3 minus n4. Because n1 minus n2 is just the difference in the number of links crossing this region and the number crossing this, which is just going to be the number of links crossing at the top. And similarly, n3 minus n4 is just the number of links crossing at the top, right? So those two will be exactly the same because of the way we've chosen this. So they cancel out exactly, and all you get left with is this finite piece, which is the topological entropy. So you get the finite piece out, and what is that finite piece? It's log 4, which is the correct answer for Z2. So at least in this example, the formula works. Okay. So I've shown you an example, but the last thing I wanted to do is just give you another viewpoint on this, which is sort of topological entropy from the continuum point of view. So this is sort of the point of view that Kitaev and Preskill emphasize. So let's consider we just have some kind of annular region in the continuum, and we compute their entanglement entropy of this region. Normally, we would say that entanglement entropy is just going to be proportional to basically the linear size of this region, the total, roughly speaking, the total length of the boundary. But the point is, if there's some kind of topological phase going on, if you're in a topological phase, there will be some kind of correlation here. So it won't be really exactly C times L. There'll be a finite correction, which is exactly this number. So this is another way of looking at that formula. It's just a way of that construction. It's just a way of isolating this finite size correction, basically. So you can view the topological entropy as just a, in general, for any phase, if you sort of compute the entropy in the continuum, it'll have a form like this. It'll be some constant times length plus a finite contribution. This constant here, the coefficient here, is not universal. It depends on microscopics. It's ultraviolet divergent. It has all kinds of problems with it. But the finite contribution is universal and finite. It has no ultraviolet divergences. And that's really what topological entropy is. It's just a way of computing, say, on a lattice, this finite universal correction. Now, the last thing I want to say is, everywhere here, I sort of emphasize the fact that we're dealing with an annulus. But once you look at things from this point of view, you can equally well talk about a disk. And the way you do that is you kind of imagine, well, the entanglement entropy of this annulus is the same thing. In general, the entanglement entropy of a region is the same thing as the entanglement entropy of its complement. So the complement to this region is just, two disks, the inner disk and then an outer disk. If we imagine this is put on a sphere. So using that kind of argument, it's not hard to see that if you did the same kind of calculation on a disk, you would again find it grows proportional to the length, and then there would be a finite correction. And that's this topological entropy, except there's a factor of 2 here because we're dealing with a disk rather than an annulus. So you can equally well, you don't have to talk about annuli to talk about this sort of finite size correction. It occurs for all regions. It's always there. And so that's basically the continuum viewpoint to this story. And the reason why I focus on annuli rather than disks is I just think it's more physical because from the point of view of these string operators. But from the point of view of this formula, a disk is just as good. There's no reason to focus on annuli. Okay, so that's most of what I wanted to say. I just wanted to conclude. So first, I hope I've convinced you that there's sort of an interesting connection between topological order and quantum entanglement. But I think there's still a lot more to be done. So in particular, we've only computed this entropy in basically for these exactly soluble models. But there are a lot of other The real questions that motivated this whole talk are these not exactly soluble ones. So I think it'd be interesting to compute it in that case and see if it tells you anything about these various systems. Another direction which is kind of interesting is everything I've talked about has been in a gap system. We have a finite gap. But you could also try to make sense of this in some sense for critical theory. I don't know if you can or not, but I think that might be an interesting direction. And then the final thing I want to say is, in some sense, my feeling is all the information should be in the wave function, not just this quantum dimension D, everything, all the statistics, S matrix, the T matrix, every aspect of the topological order is contained in the wave function. We should be able to get it out, but how do we do it? So I think that could be interesting to try to get more information. Like, for example, whether the quasi-particles, what kind of statistics they have, whether they're abelian or non-abelian, and so on. So that's it. Thanks for your attention.
How do you get the statistics of the quasi-particle just from the Gram-Gram-Seidel function? Do you need not specify the
Well, that's an open question. I think in a gap system,
it's not a well-defined question.
I think it is well-defined in the following sense. Suppose you have a Hamiltonian, and you compute the ground state, and then you hand the ground state to me, and then I don't know the Hamiltonian at all. My claim is that there's the statistics of the particle. It's impossible to have two Hamiltonians. I'm sorry. It's impossible to have a ground state which has both, say, bosonic and fermionic excitations and is gapped. That's impossible. So statistics are. Let's see. I didn't say that very well. So what I'm saying is the following, though. I'm saying, given a given wave function, it's impossible to have two different Hamiltonians. You could imagine the following situation. You have two Hamiltonians that both have that wave function as its ground state, right? And it's gapped in both cases. And in one case, the quasiparticles have one set of statistics, and the other case, they have another set of statistics. And I claim that's probably not possible. I can't prove that, but I don't think that's possible. You can't have a gap and have different statistics. So, like, you couldn't, for example, have a system which has only bosonic excitations in one Hamiltonian and has fermionic excitations in another.
Well, okay, so let me just ask you more about this. In the middle of your talk, I mentioned this example that we could have a critical state which is gapless in the same ground state wave function occurring as the first for a gap state. But you said, well, think more generically, add perturbations to the Hamiltonian once in a generic situation. But if you do that, of course, the wave function is going to change. The ground state wave function will change. And so I don't see how you can say that the topological phase is the generic occurrence of the wave function.
Okay, yes, that's a different question, yeah. So I agree, I was like, glib there or something. But
what do you think? I mean, if you look at a wave function, this would be great. I mean, so I'm not trying to discourage you, I'm just wondering if it's true. It'd be great if you could look at a wave function and identify the PQFT.
Oh, I think you can. Okay, so my claim is, I make a weaker claim than I said before. So with you, I was talking about critical theories, which maybe I was being making questionable assumptions or something. But I think the following statement is true. If given a wave function, which is a ground state of a gapped Hamiltonian, all the information about that TQFT is contained in the wave function.
Okay,
so
Okay, so here's something to worry about. Suppose there's a quantum critical phase which intermediates between two gapped phases, then isn't it possible that the wave function which sits at the quantum critical point could actually be the same wave function in both gapped phases? Because we already see an example where we're sitting at the critical point and the wave function is the same wave function as in one gapped phase.
Okay, so you want a wave, so you're saying if I take a wave function, usually a wave function for critical theory has algebraic correlations, but I guess it's possible that it doesn't for some reason.
Example.
Yeah, you have an example which doesn't. But I don't think that's possible. I don't know, can I prove that or argue that?
Let me actually add to what Mike said. I mean, in principle, assume you sit at this critical point, right? So you can open a gap by adding lots of various projectors. It's probably very difficult to open a gap with a local Hamiltonian and with adding local terms. But if you're allowed to operate some non-local terms, I think it's a pretty easy exercise.
Sure, that's not true. There are these are dealing with the billions of these things. When they started, and you vary a parameter and you go from the critical
Well, but all your Hamiltonians are local.
Yes.
All I'm saying is that if you're allowed to add non-local projectors, then you can pretty much open the gap for free by doing it in various ways.
Wait, but Mike, the theory that you were talking about, by the way.
But those aren't really contradicting what he's saying. He's saying if you give them a wave function and you give the extra information that there is a gap, then he thinks that you can identify a topological phase.
Yeah, but
there's a unique topological phase.
I mean, there are many ways of opening a gap.
No, but he's saying, I think he's also assuming it's a local Hamiltonian.
I think probably with a local Hamiltonian, there's only one topological phase with a gap with the given ground state.
You know, I think the answer may come down to the question in algebra, which is very hard to penetrate, you know, which is whether there's some tensor category that has a non-unique structure in its ideals.
Well, okay.
The fact that these precursor phases
actually
can only have a unique possible topological phase associated, it seems to me to be closely related to what looks to me like an algebraic accident in the temporary leak theory.
Okay, actually, let me explain to you why I think it's true. Actually, I think I almost have a proof of why it's true if you believe in these string operators. The question is, if you believe in these string operators here, so my claim is the following. If you have a state which is a ground state of a gapped Hamiltonian, it will have a fattened string operator like this for each of the quasi-particles. Okay. And those string operators will satisfy a certain algebra which encodes all the statistics and all the information.
No, that's not.
Well, it will encode the statistics, for example, because by how they link tells me statistics, the S matrix, for example. So that means that from the wave function, I can compute the S matrix in principle. Now the question is, the question that I was posing is, how do you do it in practice?
That's because you have an opinion based on the particular representation of the wave function you're using in terms of which is in the loops.
No, but I'm making the following claim. Maybe the claim I haven't proven is the following, but I believe this is true. All if you're a gapped ground state of a Hamiltonian, a topological phase, you will have basically, you can identify a finite number of fattened string operators corresponding to each of the quasi-particle types, and that's it. There's sort of a very well-defined collection of operators, and all the statistics is there. So it's impossible. If you had two, you couldn't do it in two ways. You would have, that would be weird. That doesn't make, doesn't, it's not consistent with this.
Well, that sounds pretty
good. So I'm saying in principle that you could detect it. I guess the question I was trying to pose is, how do you do it in practice, right? In practice, if with a real wave function, you can't find the fattened string operators. So how would you know this? I don't know. Is there any simple way of doing it in practice?
Can you repeat that?
So this is a statement which I didn't go into detail because I didn't have time. But this is true, is that all topological, if you take a ground state, if you take a topologically ordered state, there will always be these fattened string operators, and there will be one string operator for each quasi-particle type. It's a one-to-one correspondence. Okay? And the algebra of these string operators encodes the statistics of the quasi-particles. For example, if you link two of these operators, you can do constructions like this. And calculate things like the S matrix. So you can calculate all the statistics once you find these operators. So it's a question of, so all the statistics is contained there somehow in the wave function.
But then it would be true only for double theory. This one would be true for the chiral theory.
Because?
Because the string operator, that's a reference to the angle scale. So you have to pencil the angle. That's a double.
No, but all chiral theories, even chiral theories, have string operators. Even the fractional quantum Hall state has a string. No. It doesn't have string. It can't be formulated in terms of physical strings, but it does have a string operator. Yeah, there's one for each quasi-particle type.
Maybe to help clarify this argument a little bit, something you didn't say about the ground state is that it's not just superposition over all loops, but it's a superposition also over all co-loops in the lattice as well. There are two kinds of particles, actually, in this model. Corresponding to, you know, the Z operators or the X operators in the
lattice. But if you just work in this representation, the sigma X, it's just these loops. You don't have to worry about this. Yeah. But I agree that what you're getting at, I think, is the existence of the other string operator.
You can see the linkage.
Yeah. You're getting at that, right? So you're saying that basically in the Z2 case, the point is, yeah, in the Z2 case, it's clear, right? In the Z2 case, we have this string operator, which is product of sigma X. There's another string operator, which is product of sigma Z's around a loop. And then these string operators satisfy an algebra, and from that you can compute all the statistics. Yeah. So I'm claiming that's true in general. I thought, well, I don't know if that's been proven or what the situation is, but basically this idea, I think this is from Kataev's paper. He emphasized these string operators. He called them ribbon operators in his 1997 paper, and that's sort of, I thought, yeah, it was a general statement. the existence of these operators.
How do you have over and under crossings of these?
That's right. So then you have to define more structure than just the closed string. You have to also have in general, you can define open string operators. So this creates two quasi-particles at the two ends. And then by putting those together, you can create this. But you need more, you're right. You probably need more than just the closed strings. But in general, to create the open string is simple. It doesn't matter what you do at the ends. You just end it in some way. And then that creates two quasi-particles here and here. And then you can just braid another pair of quasi-particles around. And then from that, compute statistics.
In your example, you considered this the honeycomb model. What surface was that on? What was the...
Which example?
The one where you wrote down these four spaces, S1, S2, S3.
Oh, yeah. Always, the point is you don't need to put on an interesting surface. Just put in a disk. So just define on the disk with some arbitrary boundary condition and then do this somewhere in the interior. Or you could put on a sphere if that's better. It doesn't matter.
If you had considered the model on a different topologically different surface, how would it change that you would need to?
It wouldn't matter. You just take as long as you do the local. Like if you had a torus, you're saying. If you had a torus.
If you had a torus, would it be possible to detect that you had topological order on the torus just by looking at regions which were homologically non-trivial, like the four that you showed?
Oh well, I would just look within. Just take some little subregion like this, and then draw. Draw these little annuli in here. You can do that. Then I think maybe what you're getting at, what a lot of people ask is, well, can you do something around the torus? That actually runs into problems. But that actually will not give you, it depends on what's going on, what kind of system you're in. But there's some issues with doing it around the holes of the torus.
In that kind of case, would the joke be dependent on what kind of ground state you're in? Would that federal ground state in that kind of case?
Not if you do it locally like this. If you do it this way, it will depend. That's the problem, right? But if you do it locally like this, it doesn't depend. Because the local density matrix is the same for all the ground state. But if you do it around like this, it will depend on the ground state.
Just wind around the torus, it will depend on...
If you do it around, it will, because it'll depend on what sector you're in and things like that, I think.
So, sorry. Have this open string operator, doesn't that take you out of the ground state?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Your argument still holds.
No, the point is the point is once all you need the ground state for is to compute the operator, to compute the string operator. Once you have the string operator, you could, once you have the string operator, you can just apply this string operator to the ground state. That will give you some other state, right? And then you can continue this procedure, right? And then compute the amplitude once you finish the procedure, the overlap with the original ground state. And that'll give you some number. The phase of that number is related to the statistics. I don't know. It's a sketch, something like that. So you compute the overlap. What you won't get exactly back to the ground state from doing this if you're dealing with non-abelian statistics. But the phase, I think, okay. I believe something like this would work.
You were the audience's energy for a final comment on this point. I mean, I think it's interesting, so that's fine. So I understood what you said, but I'm wondering if you just know the wave function, I think it's possible that there are infinitely many string operators that you'll find just looking at the ground state wave function, and that when you compute this S matrix between them, there'll be lots of degeneracy between them, and there'll be perhaps some ambiguity as to what additional relations be added, maybe additional terms in the Hamiltonian to kill the degeneracy in different ways. So, for example, if you just have an operator that enforces lewdness, that basically bivalence in parentheses, but doesn't have a bicat term to allow you to surge your loops, then
you get basically this de-isotop in the annulus category that Juan was mentioning as infinitely many irreducibles. They basically correspond to eigenvalue under twist and the number of strings penetrating the annulus. And then you have to know some local relation in order to collapse this large number of representations to four.
So it's hard for me to understand. Well, okay, I guess I have to talk to you about that. But I guess the reason why I don't quite see that is, like, I mean, this specific example, say the Tor code, there's somehow four, I don't know how to make this exactly rigorous, there are four operators, you find them, and there are no more. All the others are just, that's it. That's the only four non-trivial string operators, and they satisfy an algebra, and then
okay,
you know.
Okay, so this is what we should look, because I think if you just look at the ground state information, I think...
No, but the question is, what are the other operators that you're talking about?
Yeah, I think that, yeah.
So I would claim there are only four, but I don't know.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, isn't he saying that you have just the ground state plus one other piece of information, which is the existence of a gap? So it seems like you're saying, well, suppose you have to consider a state that doesn't have a gap, I run into all these difficulties. But by assumption, he's saying, let's start out in a case in which I know there's a gap, right?
If pure loop happens to close a topological excitation, what kind of, effect would that have?
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a very good question. So you're asking, suppose you did this calculation and there was actually something inside.
Yes.
Okay. So that's the general formula for that is, instead of getting log b squared, you get s topological equals log d squared over di squared, or d alpha squared, where alpha is whatever's inside. So, I could explain to you, there's actually physical significance to what topological entropy is and what these quantities are. It has to do with the probability that you would have a d alpha particle in the center. If you, like, sort of disordered the system, what's the probability that you would have this kind of an excitation in the center? And the probability is of having alpha in the center is d alpha squared over d squared. That's where this comes from. But yeah, this is a general formula, which is Kitaya sort of derives this in his paper.
D alpha would be alpha is the region which also the everything is inside.
Yes.
So I guess that way we might even draw the conclusion that if the system has abelian statistics, there's no change. But
that's right.
Not abelian statistics.
There could be a change. Yeah. Yeah.
Change.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, if it's abelian, then d alpha is always 1, so it doesn't matter what particle you have on the inside. But if it's not abelian, it can change the stuff. Yeah.
Okay. Further questions should be left for